Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Richard Harris's talk, The Making of Dufferin St. Clair, 1900 to 1929. It's part of the 2011 History Matters lecture series sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on ActiveHistory.ca in the near future for recordings of subsequent talks from the 2011 History Matters lecture series.
Today I'm going to be talking about, yes, the making of Dufferin and St. Clair. And when I talk about the making of the area, I mean the area more or less as you folks, I suspect, know it today, or as we know it today. I'm not going back. There's a history before 1900, and there's a lot that can be said, you know, since 1929. But really, the area as it exists today was very much created in that period in time. So yes, this is going to be the focus, is this particular area, but I'm going to say some things at the beginning, and sorry, Miriam, could you do me the next one? There we go. Since I'm a geographer, I'm calling this a map of what I'm going to be doing today. Yes, I will get to Dufferin and St. Clair, but I want to say a few things about Toronto as well in that period. It was a period of growth and immigration. That doesn't sound like anything very distinctive to that period, but really, Toronto was growing more rapidly, at least in proportional terms at that time, than any other period before or since. Immigration was huge by any standards, and it was a period which saw an amazing boom in home ownership, and I'll be saying a fair bit more about that. And a lot of that had to do with owner building, people literally building homes with their own hands. And that's a large part, or a good part, of the story that I want to tell today. So, having said something about Toronto, then I'm going to say something about, well, I'm going to focus on Dufferin and St. Clair. What I'm going to sort of argue is that really this was, I'm calling it the epicenter of change. I mean, it was the absolutely typical growth area of Toronto at that period in time, early 20th century. And at the very, very end, I'll kind of just suggest some wider connections, ways in which Dufferin and St. Clair, at least in that period, was kind of similar to a lot of other places, although maybe some of those connections aren't always well recognized. So Toronto then, these are just some numbers. Look at that growth, doubling in size in 10 years. Those numbers look pretty small by today's standards, but that's a proportion, that's an amazing increase. Another 200,000, that's a 50%, and then another 200 in that period in time. So huge immigration. Look at the proportion there, and now non-Canadian means born outside of Canada. That proportion is roughly what it is today. And we think of Toronto today as as an immigrant city, and it is. But it was back in this period as well. But of course the difference is that overwhelmingly the people coming in at that time were Brits, especially English, but Scottish and Welsh and some Irish too, but above all the English. Most of them came with little or nothing. Literally what they could carry, and maybe not even much of that either. It's a period in time when incomes were not rising. Don't worry, I'm not going to go into the details of this graph. And someone else did the research, which is especially nice. But if you look at this, this is an index value starting in 1900. Wages for skilled workers, wages for unskilled workers were not increasing. So they weren't declining, but they weren't increasing. So people's standard of living wasn't particularly increasing at that time. The cost of housing was going up more rapidly than incomes were going up, and that doesn't sound like news either, but that was true then. But as you can see here, the proportion of people who owned their own homes, the ownership rate, in fact, it was pretty near doubling in that period of time, from 1900 to 1914, when the city doubled in size. So the city doubled in size, and the proportion of people that owned their own homes also doubled. So, I mean, that's a pretty dramatic change in just 14 years. There was a housing shortage, a housing crisis. This is a photograph taken of the ward downtown Toronto. Everyone was talking about housing problems and slums and things of that sort. And this actually focuses in a little, this graph focuses in a little bit more on that ownership rate, the home ownership rate that I was talking about before. So back as late as, well, back in 1891, you know, a little bit less than a third, in fact not much more than a quarter of people owned their own homes. By 1921, in just this short 20-year period, that proportion had gone from 27-28% up to more than 60%. Or around 60%, actually, if that's the more meaningful figure. So that's an incredible change in a really short period of time when incomes were not increasing, all these immigrants were coming in, very little in the way of savings. This was information that I had sort of put together about 20 years ago, and having put it together, I thought, how could this possibly make sense? What could be going on to enable people to acquire their own homes? Well, I spent a lot of time, figured it out, well, to my satisfaction, this was, yeah, that's an important qualification, but, and then this was a book that I wrote on that basis with a cover illustration from Lauren Harris, no relation that I know about, who painted a number of scenes. This is Earl's Court in 1921. I mean, he doesn't call it Earl's Court, but it is. And in the book and in my talk today, I'm going to be trying to give you a sense of how it is that that happened, that so many, isn't that nice? So many people were able to acquire homes in that period of time under those circumstances. So home ownership, yes, I've shown you the graph. Let's have a look at the map here. And this, of course, is Upper, this is Upper Inter Clare up here. This is the proportion, this is a map that shows the proportion of people that own their own homes, not surprisingly, of course, out in the suburbs, and these were the bits of the suburbs that were actually developed by 1921. Not surprisingly, the home ownership rate out in those areas, including Dufferin and St. Clair, was very high. In excess of three quarters of all people owned their own homes, as opposed to downtown, where it got down as low as 10% down in that area of the ward that I showed you that picture of to give you a sense of, and I'm not sure how much you'll be aware of this, probably not much, of the political geography of the city at that time, which is very important, and I'll be underlining or showing you why that political geography matters. Back in 1901, these were the city limits, those there. And then the city of Toronto, mostly in around 1910, 1911, annexed a bunch of territories. So by the end of the period, all of this North Toronto here, a good chunk of Dufferin and St. Clair, but not all of it, had been annexed. The junction, and of course, a good chunk of East Toronto as well. So the city did annex this territory, and this had a big impact on the Dufferin and St. Clair area, but it had a different impact on the southern bit as opposed to the northern bit. Just a more context, industry was moving out, jobs. I mean, industry at that time was a major source of employment. So the industry was moving out. There was a lot downtown, especially the Massey Harris plant, which many of you will remember. But out in this direction, of course, the junction was a centre, had the stockyards and so forth. The Canada Foundry, which was really important as a source of employment for this people who lived in this particular area. And then there was a CCM, that was a bicycle, with Kodak built a plant, and some of you that didn't disappear so long ago, so some of you may remember that. And of course, these were all oriented around railroads. So the industry was moving out, and of course the workers were moving out, the workers employed, the blue-collar workers who were employed in those manufacturing plants. Now, of course, there's a good concentration downtown. but they were also moving out into the suburbs, into the Dufferin and Sinclair area, New Toronto out here with the Goodyear factory, built in the 19-teens, and of course out into the East End. And I emphasize this because, you know, we think of suburbs, even today we think of suburbs as middle class sorts of places. And of course there are middle class suburbs, and there were middle class suburbs. North Toronto mostly was that way. Forest Hill, and much of Leaside. But there were working class suburbs too, and that was very much this area. To a high degree, very much settled by blue collar workers. Many of whom worked in these factories that I was just talking about. But, now there's always a transit story in Toronto, right? And there was a really very intriguing transit story in Toronto in the first, especially the first couple of decades of the 20th century. Now this shows you the streetcar network as it existed in 1921. Now until 1921, 30 years, 1891 to 1921, the streetcar network was run by a private company. And this private company did not want to extend lines out into, well, it didn't even want to extend lines into this area here, that is to say the southern part of Dufferin St Clair. There's no way it wanted to extend lines out into the suburbs. And the reason for that is because it figured, well, suburbs, low density, not profitable, let's just keep the lines, let's keep our service concentrated in the denser, more profitable parts of the urban area. Well, the city complained and grumbled, but it was stuck in this 30-year contract with the streetcar company. So it couldn't force the streetcar company to do anything other than operate the lines that existed in 1891. And the city was growing. So the city itself built some extra lines, as you can see here. Some of these were interurbans that were connected further distances. Some of them were just local lines. And it built a few of those, as you can see, and some of those did affect the Dufferin and St Clair area, but there was still a lot of settlement that happened, that was happening beyond those lines. Why is all this important? Two reasons. Number one, all of this suburban settlement that happened, especially up in here, the area right around here, happened at very high densities. I mean, much higher densities than you might have expected. And the reason for that is, well, people had to either walk to work or at least walk to the end of the streetcar line in order to get anywhere. And so there was enormous incentive for the developers, the land subdividers, to create small lots, 25-foot lots, so that they could cram lots of people in, and that in turn would enable those people to live fairly close to this streetcar service. That just gives you a sense. This was actually obviously taken downtown.
It's a picture.
From around it. Does it look familiar?
Looks like St. Clair now.
Well, that's not, that is not St. Clair. That is
like, I know, it's a dance.
Yeah. But those that photograph was taken by the city as part of its campaign against the private company that ran the streetcar system. Not that it did any good.
There's a couple chairs up here. These two much.
Yeah, there's a chair right here.
And this one.
Sure. So, all of that context, let's focus in on Dufferin and St Clair, what was happening here, and how it kind of typifies what was happening more generally. I said that, you know, there was this incredible boom in home ownership. I already mentioned own a building right at the beginning of my talk. Well, this was the key. People built their own homes, and they started with shacks. John Boy, there's quite a number of his photographs that he took out in this area. He spent one day, I think it was October the 16th, 1916, he took the streetcar out as far as he could go, and then he walked, and he took pictures. And it was very much this time of year, and there was lots of scenes like that. People starting with the absolute bare minimum. Other scenes, sometimes tents, sometimes lean-tos. You can see, you get a sense of this. One of the things that I was able to do, I won't bore you with the details, I was able to figure out, again, at least to my satisfaction, which houses, which new dwellings in this period, this particular period, which was a really, really, really boom period, I was able to figure out which dwellings were owner built as opposed to being built by a professional, profit-making builder, put it that way. And the solid dots indicate 50 owner-built new homes, so each one dot equals 50. The open circles indicate the commercial product. And as you can see, out in this area here, it's all owner-built. It's just about all of it is owner-built. And that's a function, in part, it's a function of people's income, savings, there's no way that they can afford to buy a new home under any circumstance. The other consideration, and that's why the political boundary matters, is that as long as these areas lay outside the city, and these they stay outside of the city in York Township for a long period of time, there were no building regulations. There were no building regulations. It wasn't that there were some building, and they were not very well enforced. There were no building at all. So no one cared, no one inspected. You just did, if you could buy a lot, and the lots were $5 down, if you could buy a lot and you could afford, $5 worth of lumber, you had a home. And yes, there were subdividers, land subdividers, that were happy to market to this particular business. Obviously on an individual, lot by lot, there wasn't a lot of profit to be made in that, but there were plenty of lots that they could sell. Dover Court Land and Savings Company was the big one, and they laid out an area known as the Parsons Estate, which is just to the north of Rogers Road. And as you can see, this was the Parsons Estate. $5 down. I can't read the rest of the terms there, but pretty cheap. Pretty cheap because no transit, no services, rude entry. It was, and small plots, as I've already said. So yes, definitely hardships for the people who settled in that area. Volunteer fire service, muddy roads, I read oral histories of that area at that time, and people talk, so-and-so shack went up in flames, this was hardly even news. This just happened all the time. 1907-1908, that winter, was a really tough winter. A lot of immigrants coming in. It was just a mini recession, but it's something that dramatically affected these people. This is a cartoon from the Globe, as you can see in February 1908. This is Shackland. And this area right around here and just to the north of where we are right now, this was, as I said before, the epicenter. I mean, when people talked about Shackland, and that was a term that was used, or when they were, drawing cartoons like that, or when John Boyd wanted to take pictures, this was where he came. Anywhere in Toronto, this was. So yeah, hardships, but rewards too. And you read the oral histories, and they talk about the kids who grew up in this area, fantastic, it's homemade kites and so forth. This is the boys, this is the brunch, and the girls. Yes, well, we won't go there. But next one. And community building. And the Earlsport Methodist Church, Reverend Peter Bryce, who came from the East Coast, played an absolutely critical role. Ran daycare centers. Did all sorts of community-based organizing at that time from, as you can see, a very, very early date. And then, yes, the library came in 1913. There it is. And the shacks were improved. Yes, many of them did start out as shacks like this here. This fellow standing proudly in front of it, mind you, but yeah, it started out that way. very soon, I mean, not so much improved in this case as just replaced, clearly. But and sometimes, yes, sometimes maybe a builder was employed, but typically still the improvement was done by the owner. Next one, please. This is a watercolor painting that appeared in a book called The Promised Land. Anyway, it was done by Henry Copping. He was a Brit who visited Toronto. And where would he go if he wanted to see what was happening in Toronto in 1911? He came out to Earls Court, did this watercolor of what he called, this is his phrase, the two stages of development in Earls Court. So stage one, and then the improved, much improved version. And this is a sort of a before and after plan that I drew up from based on what used to be produced, insurance atlases. These were produced for insurance companies to figure out the insurance premiums for homes, the fires associated with. Back in 1912, this is a, I don't know whether you know this particular block here, but on Holmesdale Road, this is in North Earls Court, north of Roberts Road. This is the footprint of the houses that existed there in 1912. And they're all single story frame, very modest. All sorts of different setbacks from the street, right? Remember, no regulations, no one's telling them, oh no, it's all gotta be, you know, at least X number of feet from the front or X number of feet from the side of the lot or anything of that sort. Nothing of that. People did whatever they wanted. Over the next 22 years, you can see all the infilling, the changes, and some disappearances. Right? But you know, look at this here. Who knows? Looks like that's gone, but maybe it's been brought to the front of the lot. See what sometimes happens. People build something small at the back. Then when they improved it, they brought it to the front and expanded. All kinds of variations on it. And that's the landscape. It's one of my favorite photos. This is 14th of October, I beg your pardon. One of those that John Boyd took that day. And you can see everything from these shacks here to more substantial homes such as these. This almost certainly, I don't know, but that type of house was quite likely to have been a kit home. You could buy kits, which would be from a mail order company, and they would ship it, and then you'd have to somehow get it to the lot. They wouldn't ship it to the lot. You'd have to get it there, and then it came with instructions, and you assembled it. And that was a very generic type of, very typical sort of kit house from that point. So there's just another, out in the middle of nowhere kind of, almost certainly owned a building because it's rather eccentric, although brick, which is interesting. And this is the area, I guess, the Parsons estate. They're staying up into Fairbank. And this is from the insurance atlas in 1912, and you can see there's just this random scattering of houses over this terrain. And some of you may know those particular blocks and know that there's quite a bit of relief. Just another scene around that same period in time, indicating that yes, factories, at least some employment was within walking distance, although most people did in fact commute all the way downtown. Many people commute downtown. Public improvements. I've already mentioned the library, and the library was good. Transit, when it came, was, as you can see, welcomed. This was the opening of the streetcar on Rogers Road. 1925, the TTC, or the public agency that took over, took over the streetcar system in 1921, and they immediately started to extend lines out into the suburbs, and this was one of the lines. And of course, it was a big celebration because finally the area had a much better streetcar system access, which enabled commuting. I mean, back in 1911, people in this area, and that's exactly this area right here, you know, they could get to local factories on foot. Some people walked downtown. All of the studies talk about people who walked downtown. But and that would have been to save money. Most people would have walked to the streetcar line and taken the car out. But yes, public investment was had many beneficial aspects, the library, the and so on. But what happened when the city annexed those areas? I talked about that annexation process that happened back in 1909, 1910, 11, thereabouts. As soon as those areas came within the city, they came under the city's building regulations. And the city also had requirements that anyone who had been incorporated into the city, including this area right around here, then had to, well, water lines and sewer lines were extended, and people had to hook up to those. You didn't have a choice. And you might think, well, why would you want to have a choice about that? Well, the obvious reason was keep your taxes low. And taxes jumped, property taxes jumped, when the water lines and the sewer lines and the sidewalks, this is a brand new sidewalk that had just gone in, sorry, I don't know the name of this particular street, but, you know, servicing these shacks, property tax on those shacks probably went up 300 or 400% overnight. Well, the amount of money we're talking about is not huge, but for people who had just built that shack and who had very limited incomes, it had a huge impact. And you can see that, you know, these areas that were being recently annexed by the city, and the city then says, okay, you know, you have to make these improvements. These sanitary improvements and the people have to hook up to the water lines and the sewer lines. Where did this happen? Well, it was all this recently annexed territory. And above all, the greatest, tightest cluster is right around here. This is where people, where the city was installing services, people had to hook up, taxis went up. And many people were able to handle that. And then some people maybe not so well. And that was especially true after 1929, of course, for all the obvious reasons. Some people had problems even in the 1920s. People were losing their homes because they couldn't pay the taxes. But of course, after 1929, it was a really big deal. And so, in a sense, it's not the same, but it's sort of similar to some of what's been happening in the United States in the last two or three years. People getting into situations which they can't sustain in terms of being able to afford it. Now, the circumstances are somewhat different, but they had overextended themselves. And so some of these public improvements sound good, but for some people it was problematic. I've emphasized, obviously, because that's supposed to be what I'm talking about, Dufferin and St. Clair, but I also want to say or point out that, yeah, the same sort of thing was happening in other parts of Toronto. So this is a photograph taken on Coxwell out in the East End, 1912. Exactly the same sort of pattern, not on as big a scale, but very much the same sort of thing. So it wasn't just this area of Toronto, it was other parts. And it wasn't by any means unique to Toronto either, and I've done some research in Peoria, Illinois. And if anyone wants to know why, I'll explain that later. Has anyone heard the phrase, will it play in Peoria?
Sure, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why I picked Peoria. Well, that's one of the reasons I picked Peoria. I thought, well, it's the quintessential middle American, you know, mid-sized town. And Peoria had a staggering amount of owner building, just unbelievable amounts. I could go on for hours about Peoria. We don't. But yes, it had lots and lots of this sort of development. Yeah, and you don't even have to stick to North America. Obviously, you can go to the third world, you know, to find shacks, yes. But go to Europe. Suburban Paris, 1925. You go to suburban Athens, same period of time. Lots and lots of European cities in that same period of time. Same type of development. And of course, the details of the architecture are a little bit different. The process is fundamentally the same. So, what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that Dufferin Sinclair has a very interesting story, but it's not a wholly unique story.
You've been listening to a recording of Richard Harris's talk, The Making of Dufferin St. Clair, 1900 to 1929. It is part of the 2011 History Matters lecture series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. Please check back on activehistory.ca in the near future for subsequent recordings of the 2011 History Matters lecture series.